Translation by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. O Brahmanas, just accept me as a completely surrendered soul, and let Mother Ganges, the representative of the Lord, also accept me in that way, for I have already taken the lotus feet of the Lord into my heart. Let the snake bird, or whatever magical thing the Brahmana created, bite me at once. I only desire that you all continue singing the deeds of Lord Vishnu. Purport. As soon as one is given up completely unto the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord, he is not at all afraid of death. The atmosphere created by the presence of great devotees of the Lord on the bank of the Ganges and Maharaj Parikshit's complete acceptance of the Lord's lotus feet was sufficient guarantee to the king for going back to Godhead. He thus became absolutely free from all fear of death. Srila Prabhupada ki. So it's a very serious attitude on the part of Maharaj Parikshit. A very serious attitude, and it's similar to the verse I spoke on last time in the early part of the chapter, where Maharaj Parikshit is awaiting and hoping that he will receive the reactions of his sinful behavior as quickly as possible. So here is the same theme, really, that he has heard that there will be a snake bird which will come to bite him, and he is welcoming that eventuality and hoping it will happen quickly. As he says, let the snake bird or whatever magical thing the Brahmana created bite me at once, because I have already taken the lotus feet of the Lord into my heart. And when a devotee has captured the lotus feet of the Lord in their heart, they are somewhat indifferent to the affairs of this material world, the options for pleasure, the possibility of pain, all the ambitions, hopes, desires, lamentations, regrets. They become somewhat indifferent to them. And it is actually no small thing that Maharaj Parikshit declares that he has taken the lotus feet of the Lord into his heart. That is something we are all trying to do. That's the goal of our long attempt in Krishna consciousness, which can be decades, it can be lifetimes. It could be a moment, of course, for some people, but certainly I think for me it could take a little longer than a moment. It's a difficult project, made difficult by the fact that we hold on to so many things in this world. Actually, to grasp the lotus feet of Lord Krishna is the easiest thing in the world, because it's the most natural thing to do. It's our constitutional position to be associated with the Lord, to be connected to the Lord. And his lotus feet are supposed to be the sole refuge, the object that we grasp throughout our life, lives. But we complicate it because we've chosen many other crutches and crooks and canes and supports. And they manifest in all different forms, whether it's wealth, health, can be austerity for some, that can be a source of great pride for some people, a great austerity, whether it's a bank balance for someone, maybe it's their beauty, maybe it's their strength, maybe it's their ability to manipulate and control others. Different people take shelter of different things, and those become the items that they depend on in their lives. And so when you have all of these items, and they're accessible, and if you need some money, you can just go to the bank and just withdraw it straight away. It's there, instant, easily available. Then the prospect of trying to grasp the lotus feet of Krishna, which are a little more intangible, and a little more difficult to get hold of. You can't just type in your PIN and Krishna's lotus feet will manifest. It's not quite that simple. But the prize is worth much more. The value of that prize is much more. But there is that distance between our desire to have it and us getting it that sometimes causes some people to think, oh, it doesn't exist. Possibility doesn't exist. Because I've been asking Krishna for so long, give me shelter, give me your lotus feet, take away all these problems in my heart, these anarthas, lust, anger, greed, pride, envy. And it's just not happening. So either I'm a gone case and even Krishna can't rectify me, or maybe Krishna doesn't quite exist. So I better carry on with a few other things just along the way, just in case. Just in case this turns out to be one big imagination. Well, Prabhupada was quite amusing when he dealt with this kind of concept. He said, I mean, the materialists say that, you know, you're wasting your life. You negate all types of sense gratification. You practice austerities. And what if at the end of it all, there is no Krishna? They say you will have wasted your entire life. Prabhupada said, actually, no, what we can say to them is that even if there is no Krishna at the end of it, we've had nice sangha with wholesome, nice devotees. We've danced, we've chanted, we've sung, we've had tasty prasadam, we've had a great time. Even if there's no Krishna at the end of it, we've had a great time. What can the materialists say, even to this insignificant point? They can say that they've struggled throughout their whole life, engaged in many, many sinful activities, undergone many sinful and heavy, burdensome projects just to maintain their sinful lifestyle. They felt happiness only a small portion or percentage of the time. Just from a very simple materialistic point of view, the lifestyle of a devotee cannot be exceeded. And what to speak of the actual real result of the lifestyle of a devotee, which is a life of eternal bliss with Krishna. That's a prize which is incomparable. As I heard someone say once, I think it was Sutapa Prabhu or someone else, people say, you know, what will you get as a pension at the end of your Krishna conscious career? What pension will you get? Or what salary will you get through Krishna consciousness? What would be your reward? You know, people go to work, they get some salary. So when you do your Krishna consciousness, what do you get as your reward? And the answer was given that actually, no, there isn't much reward in terms of monetary value while you're practicing, but the retirement package is out of this world. Right? The retirement package cannot be exceeded. In the past, you had final salary schemes. Now they've started to wind those all down because it's too expensive. But just imagine, Krishna doesn't have any shortage of funds to support the pension scheme. Krishna's got a pension scheme lined up for everyone, which involves kalpavriksha trees, kamadenu cows, gemstones, rubies, lots of fun, and most important, service to him. So Krishna does not have to comply with or be subject to any of the limitations that anyone in this world has. And even on this basic point, the lifestyle of a devotee is so glorious. So this is why Maharaj Parikshit is at this stage, he has taken shelter of the lotus feet of the Lord. Now he declares that somehow he was so fallen that Krishna had to put him through this situation just so he could come to this understanding, to actually give up his complete attachment to his mundane family life and his mundane kingdom and all his courtiers and everyone, the whole thing that goes along with his lifestyle. He felt that he was so contaminated and so fallen into this condition that Krishna had to send him this very severe punishment just in order for him to finally get the message. And that's Parikshit Maharaj's viewpoint. Of course, we know Parikshit Maharaj is someone exceptional. It was right from his birth, right from before his birth actually, in the womb, he had darshan of Krishna. Because Parikshit Maharaj was directly saved by Krishna when he was in the womb. And Krishna was there dispelling the radiation of the Brahmastra and protected. And Parikshit Maharaj saw that beautiful personality whirling around, destroying the radiation. That's how it's described in the Bhagavatam. That personality was so captivating that for the rest of his life, the entirety of his life, you could say, from the point at which he took birth, was dedicated towards finding that personality again. You would examine each person. Are you this person? Are you the person I saw in the womb? Are you that person? And so Parikshit Maharaj's life was something special as well. We know his glories, his attempt to maintain dharma, his attempt to establish very strongly the principles of cow protection against the onslaught of Kali, and his basic tendency to rule the kingdom, to create facilities so that Brahminical culture can be established. I was just hearing this morning a class by Prabhupada where he said that the Kshatriya's duty is to not just to protect the citizens. Obviously, we know Kshatriyas are supposed to protect Shaurim, Dhritir, Tejo, Dakshyad, you know, some of the tasks, some of the qualities of a Kshatriya. They act with heroism, power, courage to protect the citizens. But it's not protection for the purpose of sense gratification or increasing sense gratification. The Kshatriya's duty is to protect the citizens so that they can carry out Brahminical activities. Or they can support those who carry out Brahminical activities, and thereby they derive the benefit and the pleasure. So this is the job of a ruler, a king, a Kshatriya, to actually prioritize that culture. Because that is the essence. That Brahminical culture brings one to the lotus feet of the Lord. And when one has become attracted by the lotus feet of the Lord and has captured those lotus feet, then actually the presence of the Lord accompanies that devotee. So here it is spoken about Mother Ganga. And Parikshit Maharaj says, just accept me as a completely surrendered soul and let Mother Ganges, the representative of the Lord, also accept me in that way. Well, she is the representative of the Lord. There are many pastimes as to how she appears. Multiple different versions. We know, of course, Vaman lived during that pastime when he expanded himself in the court of Bali Maharaj. His toe pierced the covering of the universe, and Mother Ganga was able to enter. That's the mechanism by which she entered. And from that point, she's been available. It's also said that when Brahma was washing the lotus feet of the Lord with water from his Kamandulu, that is the origin of the Ganga. And actually in the ninth canto, there's also the story of, in the dynasty of Amshuman, there was a king called Dilipa. And this king wanted to, on earth, he wanted to attract Mother Ganga to come. But unfortunately, he didn't manage. He was trying different ways, and he passed away, sadly, as everyone does. And that project was left incomplete. But then his son, Bhagiratha, he took up this task, and he underwent great austerities and penances he conducted. And Mother Ganga appeared to him, and she said, "What would you like, benediction?" And he said, "I would like you to come to earth and to deliver my forefathers." That was the intention, that all their forefathers who had passed away, they needed to be delivered, because that's the duty of the son, to consider the welfare of predecessors. And that is why the son is supposed to carry out binda and all sorts of other things like that. So he specifically wanted Mother Ganga to come and to deliver these forefathers. So we get an idea of just how powerful Mother Ganga is. Because she directly emanates from the feet of Lord Vishnu. It's very, very special. She carries the mercy of the Lord's lotus feet. So Mother Ganga heard this request and she said, "Okay, that's interesting. But you have to consider two items for me. There are two things you have to deal with first. First is that when I come down to earth, I will come with great force from a considerable distance. And if that force of my waters is not arrested somehow stopped, contained, then I will descend all the way down to Patala Loka. I don't want to go there. Somehow you've got to figure out how to stop my fearsome stream in its path." And then she said the second thing is that there will be many sinful men who will bathe in my waters. And they will leave all their sins in my waters. And you have to do something about that too. Because Because that's not a healthy state for me to be in. I can't come if everyone's just going to dump all their sins in me. Somehow there has to be some vacuuming process as well to go along with that. And so Bhagirath said, okay, for the first one it's quite easy. And he went to see Lord Shiva, and Lord Shiva agreed to be the person who would receive the force of Mother Ganga's waters on his head. And we know that's the picture, right? We see Mother Ganga lands on his head and then trickles down. And then the second one, King Bhagirath thought, and then he recalled the power of the devotees, and more and specifically the power of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Because there is only one person who can nullify sins. That is the Supreme Lord. No one else. He has that power to nullify and vanquish sinful reactions. That's why we read, you know, so many different processes are there described in the Nectar of Devotion in the Bhagavad Gita as to how sinful reactions can be destroyed. Now, one who has attained to the state of transcendental knowledge no longer has any further need to undergo the reactions of their sinful behavior. So the Supreme Lord is that powerful agent who can alone destroy sins. And the devotees of the Lord, because they carry the Supreme Lord in their hearts, wherever they go, they also carry the presence and the potency of the Supreme Lord to that place. There's that verse when Vidura, Bhavatvida Bhagavata, Stirtha Bhuta Swayam Vibho, Tirthi Kurvanti Tirthani Swantastena Gadabrita. Because you carry the Supreme Personality of Godhead in your heart, you turn all places into places of pilgrimage. So King Bhagiratha assured Mother Ganga that, yes, different people will deposit their sins in you, but what will also happen is that the pure devotees will also bathe in your waters. And when the pure devotees bathe in your waters, Lord Krishna's presence will be there. And that will counteract the sins that have been deposited. So Mother Ganga said, yes, that's a good arrangement, and she agreed to come. So now just imagine, for those who understand some culture, they accept Mother Ganga as a very worshipable person. And bathing in Ganga, bathing in a holy river, is definitely a key aspect of any devotee, especially on pilgrimage. When Vidura and others left to go on pilgrimage, they would go to different places, bathe in the rivers, bathe in the holy rivers, and hear katha about the Supreme Lord. So this is a standard pastime. When you go to a holy place, you bathe in the sacred waters there, and you try to purify yourself through austerity, penance, service. And so this is a very interesting and powerful way that Mother Ganga gives us this facility. Now, if we think about it from Mother Ganga's point of view, it's quite a noble task that she's doing. She's agreeing to act as the receptacle for a load of nonsense from a lot of people. She's agreeing to be the recipient of a lot of troublesome items. And she undergoes that austerity as a service to the Lord and as a service to the devotees. It's a very generous mood. It's a mood that we can also reflect on as we try to encourage and assist others in Krishna consciousness. We may have to deal with a few austerities ourselves, perhaps due to the behavior of other people who do not quite fall into our ideas of how behavior should be done. Some people approach spiritual life with a kind of view that I am so expert in my austerities, and I am so expert in my practice and my consciousness and my ability to do this, that, or whatever it is, service. And others who do not fit into that sort of standard or adopt the same mentality that I have and tick all the right boxes in the right times, and they're not worthy to be around me. Therefore, better they go somewhere else. Or we better find some other situation for them. That's an interesting thing. It comes from false ego. It's simply a product of false ego. That someone who doesn't match my ideas of correct behavior should be removed. Rather than an alternative approach, which could be that, yes, somehow this person is a source of trouble to me, potentially trouble, but still, for that person's welfare, I can tolerate that. Now, who better than Mother Ganga for demonstrating that? She accepts all these sinful reactions. I mean, we're talking about it very lightly. Now just consider our own sinful reactions. They're probably quite enormous. And then let's consider the aggregate sinful reactions of the entirety of the people in the world. It's a lot. And so what she's agreeing to do, to take on board, is something very special. And so if we also adopt that mentality that I have to tolerate, and as a service, I may even agree to accept some of the difficulties that another person is going through in order to help that person. This mood is actually found throughout all the great saintly devotees. Lord Shiva agrees to hold poison in his throat from the churning of the milk ocean. It's not a nice thing, and the effect of that poison, this hala hala poison, is so powerful that it makes his throat go blue. And Lord Shiva does that. He doesn't say, oh, let them suffer anyway. I mean, the poison, let them deal with it. He says, no, I'll take it. Lord Jesus Christ agrees to take the sins of all of the sinful people just so that they have a chance to do something auspicious, something progressive. It is a trait found in saintly persons that they agree to accept some austerity in order that others can be assisted in their Krishna consciousness. And it's easier said than done. It requires maturity, it requires a desire to see not ourselves or our own progress as the goal, but the actual pleasure of Lord Krishna as the goal. Because he wants every single living entity to come back to him. Lord Shiva hangs around with rather low-grade individuals like hobgoblins, ghosts, bhutas, pretas, pisachas. And he doesn't do that because he likes that kind of company. He does it as a great austerity. He does it as a great austerity and a great service. Because by his mercy, those individuals get a chance to have some progress made in their lives due to his association. When someone serves someone, regardless of whether they understand that person's greatness or whatever it is, they receive some of the results and some of the piety and some of the potency of the person that they serve. As I mentioned before, in the beginning, when devotees served Prabhupada, they didn't really know who he was, what the philosophy was. Books weren't published. But somehow that effort, that act of serving him, whether it's doing a little service here or there, or as we read in the Lilamrita, one hippie brought Prabhupada a toilet roll once. Because he thought, okay, it's my contribution. I'll bring you guys a toilet roll. Okay? It was useful. And it was that person's service, without clear understanding of what he was doing, but he offered some service. And all of these persons benefited greatly. So when one serves, Syan Mahat Sevaya Vipra Punya Tirthani Shevana, that when one renders service by accident somehow to a saintly person, one's taste, one's desire to hear about the Lord actually starts. That little service qualifies one to develop the desire to hear about the Lord. Shri Shri Radha Gokulananda Ki Jai. We can observe that there are so many people who have the chance to hear about the Lord. So many people, right? There's literature available in so many forums, on the internet, in person, in different places. But how many people actually want to hear about Him? Very little, very few. So the desire to hear about the Lord is itself a major achievement. And so the devotees can do that. So great devotees who adopt a mood of wanting to take on board personal austerity in order to help others, they are considered very dear by the Lord. And the Lord takes care of them, and he takes care of everyone who depends on them. So it's a wonderful system. And here Parikshit Maharaj is glorifying this principle, because he is now talking to these brahmanas. He says, "Oh brahmanas, accept me as a completely surrendered soul." He is in this assembly of great exalted sages, and he says, "I don't care what happens to me. I only desire that you all continue singing the deeds of Lord Vishnu." That is his desire, that he wants the glories of the Supreme Lord to be sung and chanted. And that is the purifying agent for this world. When in the association of devotees, Satam Prasangan Mamavirya Samvido Bhavanti Ratkarana Rasayana Kata Joshanam Ashva Pavargavartmani Shradharatir Bhakti Nukramishati, that in the association of the great devotees, in the association of the exalted sadhus, one's receptivity increases. When one hears messages, transcendental messages coming into the ear, they go straight to the heart. And that causes one to develop great taste for the messages of the Lord. And one receives a very sublime result from that hearing process. So in the association of devotees, this is always recommended. Sometimes, you know, we listen, stuff goes in through our ear, one ear out of the other. Sometimes it doesn't even make it through, just reflects straight out. Prabhupada said in one class, he said, the holes of our body are filled with nonsense. The eye holes and the ear holes, and we fill them with nonsense. So what we should do is stop filling them with nonsense and instead fill them with Krishna. Fill them with Krishna Katha. Look at his beautiful form. Fill the ears with topics of the Lord, not nonsense. I just found that amusing. So in that assembly of devotees, the great discussions of the Lord take place. And that leads to purification. And one can even get to the stage of Parikshit Maharaj's consciousness, which is that he is completely fearless. Rupa says, you know, that one is fearless, and as soon as one is given up completely unto the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord, he's not at all afraid of death. Well, some people out of great ego and boldness also declare, "I'm not afraid of death." But, you know, we can kind of view their words without too much importance, because they haven't got a clue what death is, what the consequence of death is. From a platform of ignorance, we can make all sorts of declarations, and other ignorant people can be inspired and enlivened by those words. That's a common theme in Kali Yuga, right? One ignorant person presents a point with great charisma, great articulation, and a whole group of other ignorant people take that person, "Oh yes, you must be definitely all-knowing, I will follow you." And even if they don't say these words, they still do it. So that's why across the TV screens, what types of people are paraded? People who are expert sense enjoyers, people who are expert at acquiring wealth, people who've worked out how to enjoy nicely. A platform of ignorance. And who is inspired by that? Everyone else on the platform of ignorance. The saintly devotees are not remotely interested, nor even is someone on a higher platform of goodness really interested in that. But that's what happens, that when one is in that sort of low mentality, something insubstantial is accepted as being something valuable or desirable. So when an ignorant person declares, "I'm not afraid of hell," you know, we can't take it too seriously. Because a sensible person should be very much afraid of hell. It's not pleasant. That's the whole point of it. It's rather unpleasant in proportion to the unpleasant things we do in this world. Some people spend an entire lifetime living off slaughter, their entire life. hundreds and thousands of animals killed without a second thought. And do they really think there's no consequence to it? If you have some sort of sanity about you, you will at least think there is going to be some consequence to this. This unlimited slaughter, cruelty, for my own needs, so-called needs, which can be met through other means easily, is that some people have no qualms even about the thought of it. It's to do with conditioning. When we are educated in a situation of ignorance, we consider ignorant activities to be quite okay, quite acceptable. But if you happen to know that there is always a consequence to punishment, a consequence to sinful activity, then it would not be a surprise that there are many sinful reactions awaiting people who engage in sinful activities. And therefore, hell, which is the term used for the place where you may suffer, which isn't necessarily restricted to a particular location down below somewhere, there are places in this world which are very hellish, and some people, depending on their mentality, may have a hellish experience in a place where another person might think it's heavenly. So hell is a condition of experience for us, which can actually, it's not really restricted to a place, but nevertheless there are places described where the experience on offer is is of an extra special quality. You know, you can all have fun, you know, just in your back garden. But you can also go to a theme park, you know, Disneyland or somewhere, and have more fun. So yes, in this place you could have a hellish experience. But if you want a real proper hellish experience, yes, there are some expert locations also created. Theme parks. Theme parks created where you can have an ultimate experience. So anyone who understands this takes it seriously. In fact, different writers in the past in different traditions, Dante's Purgatory, if anyone has looked at that, is a very exquisite work of describing different hells, the different places that one goes to, in a sort of a classical literature sense. So the concept is there and is taken seriously by those who are serious. Now for a devotee, when a devotee says they're not concerned about heaven or hell, we have to understand that very carefully. This is not the trivial speech of a mundane, sinful person. This means that something has happened that now excludes them from that entire process. That is very significant. Narayana para sarve nakutaschana bibhyati swarga pavarga narakeshwa pituliyartha darshinaha. So this verse was spoken when Chitraketu Maharaj was cursed to come down to hellish planets like the earth by Mother Parvati. And he accepted that curse with great happiness. And the verse was spoken to describe the fact that a great devotee, Narayana Parasarve, who is completely surrendered to the lotus feet of Narayan, has no fear anywhere in this world. Nakutaschana bibhyati. Swarga apavarga naraka. Whether one is in the heavenly planets, in the middle planets, or whether in naraka, in the hellish planets, apituliyartha darshana, because that person is completely surrendered to the lotus feet of the Lord, those locations are completely unimportant. Because they know that their conduct, their existence, is not this body. Neither is it where the body is located, neither is it all the symptoms and consequences and attachment to the modes that comes with the body. That's all going to be there in every body that we get. Whatever body it is, whichever species, whichever size, whichever shape, whichever country, nationality. We get a whole package of properties that go with it. But a devotee knows that his real identity is none of these. That is not connected to the situation either. When a devotee has grasped the Supreme Lord, his lotus feet in his heart, he can actually be situated in that consciousness. And so that is a real state of existence. And that's the state which is natural for us, actually. As I said at the beginning, it's natural. It's not an artificial imposition on the mind. We're naturally supposed to have the Lord's lotus feet in our hearts and as a source of our shelter. So when we do that, we can be on this stage. of indifferent to the activities of this world. Okay, I'll stop there. Are there any questions, comments? Yes.
Hare Krishna, Prabhuji. Thank you so much for a wonderful class. So much nectar in this class. One of the questions that I had, at the beginning of the class, you mentioned that we cannot grasp the lotus feet because of different attachments that we have. And actually, I have two questions. First question is, how to identify what we're attached to? How do we realize, okay, this is what I need to work through, this is what my attachments are, this is what's stopping me? And my second question is, how do we not get attached to, for example, beautiful devotees that we spend the last 3 or 4 months with, that we know that we'll move on soon? And yeah, this is like how to deal with that kind of sadness, you know.
Yes, well, we can view the two in a different way, actually. They're different things. The first one about identifying our attachments. Often we know what the attachments are, because they're ingrained in us. They're things we naturally gravitate towards. It requires a little contemplation. Often we do these things mechanically or just out of instinct, because we're attracted to certain things. It can be taste, it can be items, it can be places, it can be scenery, it can be music, it can be something like that. What we need to do is just observe ourselves. Actually, a little bit of self-observation is useful sometimes. You just take yourself out of your body and your mind and just observe yourself. At the moment, my decisions are based upon what mental concoctions, what mental facts, or what is my state that is going to now contribute to my next activity? What is going on in my head? That can be useful. I mean, don't do it too much, otherwise you end up so self, how can you say, scrutinizing, that you forget how to live. you're just constantly thinking and just... This is an exercise to be done occasionally. So every so often, maybe you look back on a day and you think, during this day, I did this activity, then I did this one, and I did that one, and I went for this, and I had a fight with this person, and I had an argument with this person, and what happened during that time? What was going on in my head? That will often give us a very good idea of what the attachments were. Because typically we have negative experiences when our attachments aren't fulfilled or our desires aren't fulfilled. That tends to result in either anger or something like that. And we sometimes make choices based upon what we think will give us happiness, which largely means we are attached to that, or at least that concept. So we go for a certain thing because we think we'll get it. So sometimes just putting ourselves out of ourselves and just observing, what do? It's a useful way to gain insight into that. Otherwise, sometimes people will tell us, we might not always accept it straight away, "Prabhu, you're just attached." Someone might say that to you. We might say, "What do you think? What do you know? How do you know I'm attached to you?" That's probably a sign, actually. You may be attached. Because when someone reveals something about us, we often rebel against it immediately. So it can be another indicator. That when you're around others and you're close to them, they will probably say things to you that might be instructive, if we can accept them. So through those two ways, you can uncover for yourself what the specific attachments are. Because each person has something different. You can group them broadly into the same category. They're all based on lust, right? The desire to enjoy in this world. That's kama esha, krodha esha, rajagunasamudbhava. You know, So when Arjuna says to Krishna, where does this urge come from to perform sinful activities? From lust only, Krishna says. So ultimately that propensity to enjoy in this world is the root cause of all our attachments, anarthas, everything, the whole lot. So somehow if we can limit it to that, actually, as an analysis, if you want. We can just look at that and just say, that's the cause of it, and I just have to deal with this. But if you want to go into more of a detailed approach and actually try and identify the specific things, and then try and be more conscious next time that thought comes in the mind, then that's also a very good exercise to do, to think about it. Now the second part regarding association with devotees, that shouldn't be considered in the same category as material attachment. To be attached to the devotees of the Lord is something highly desirable. And to want their association, to want their company, to want to be with them, that is something that great acharyas aspire for. Some write that they wish to just be an insect trampled on the ground by the devotees. Some of them wish to just be hanging around the devotees. You can imagine, I mean, we have different animals and creatures around the manor and other places. Sometimes devotees imagine they'll be like one of the ducks on the lake. The devotees will feed them prasadam until someone turns up and says, stop feeding the ducks. Or you could be a goose or a cow. That can happen. Now, of course, it's not really desirable to want an animal life. It's not a desired life. But the principle of being around devotees is a good principle. It's the kind of principle that Parikshit Maharaj is referring to here as well. In the next verse, actually, I won't speak too much on it, but he says, association with his devotees, he says, he wants to be detached from the material world, but he wants to have attachment to Krishna, association with his devotees and friendly relations. And he wants that. So we should not give up. We should not detach ourselves from the devotees. You know, when we become detached, when we adopt great vairagya, renunciation, in the Shastra it does not say we renounce the devotees. We definitely try to keep ourselves in their association as much as possible. That is what the saintly persons do. It's what the great saints do. When Vidura goes on pilgrimage, he hears from persons. Uddhava, Maitreya. All these interactions take place. Balaram goes on pilgrimage. So many persons go on pilgrimage. They hear from the great devotees. They bathe in the waters of the Ganga. They carry out the spiritual practices. So, yes, there might be sadness at a particular situation, a particular group of devotees, a particular group of friends. But really, as we say, the eternal link is there through the holy name. And so when one chants the holy name and the other person also chants the holy name, there is a connection there which is above the bodily platform. And it is a connection through a transcendental realm. And so Shruti Dharma Prabhu said once that actually Krishna is here, and you know, we know everything about him. We know where he lives, we know who his mother is, we know who his father is, who his friends are, who he hangs out with, who his girlfriends are. We know all of that. We also know his phone number. You can just ring up Krishna when you want. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare. That is possible also. That you can... There's no answering machine, there's no voicemail, no engaged tone. You chant it correctly, you get straight through. No secretaries to go through either. So that's what's possible with Krishna. So association, when we dial up Krishna, we are connected to Krishna and all of his parts and parcels. Ekala Ishvara Krishna Arasabha Vrittya. Every single person who is a servant of Krishna's is also connected to us through that process when we serve Krishna. So, yeah, association, but yeah, we can miss people also. That's normal.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Comments? David Prabhu?
Thank you for the class. My question is, how do we like overcome, in terms of like conditionings, and how do we overcome shame, and how do we also accept others based on their conditioning or previous conditioning?
How do we accept them?
Yes, like, yeah, accept it.
Well, that can mean different things. Accept means either you personally in your mind feel happy about that person in that sense, or you tolerate. It can mean different things. How you accept something?
No, that it's okay. That it you see that it's completely like purified in a sense.
Right. Yes, well, one thing we can always remember is that each person who's connected to Krishna somehow, or who has connected themselves to Krishna, is very, very special to Krishna. Very special. Regardless of whatever effects they're displaying. You know, in a hospital, there's this example given sometimes, you know, the patient goes to the hospital, there's coughing and spluttering and all of that stuff that goes on with it, and the nurse is attending to the patient carefully. And every so often, the patient might cough and it might land on the nurse or the doctor. And the doctor doesn't kick the person out of the hospital because, you know, they've insulted them. They accept that this is a consequence of that person's diseased condition. And therefore, they tolerate. They tolerate. As far as possible, they protect themselves with masks, overalls, you know, that whole stuff. They protect themselves. So our protection, when we're dealing with devotees with sinful tendencies or whatever it is, that protection is something different. It's needed. But with that protection, we still, as an austerity, as a duty, as a service, accept the presence of that person. It's, in some cases, in some ways, it's good tolerance for us, a good tolerance exercise. If we have the right, intellectual process to go with it. If you're forced to tolerate something and it is simply done as a matter of resentment, I'm going to tolerate this person and I hate him and every moment I can't stand him and this goes on for a long time, then it's questionable as to the level of benefit you'll be getting from that exercise. Okay, you physically tolerate it. It's questionable whether there's benefit. That rather has to be accompanied with an internal desire to purify ourselves. That, okay, what is it, and as I mentioned when Mataji was asking the question, what is it that has driven me to act in this way? What is my attachment in this regard? He does this which I don't like. What is it about me what am I attached to that causes that to be a problem for me? If our tolerance goes simultaneously along with that kind of process, in the mind level as well, just in a point of consideration, then we actually could get benefit from that. But there are many people who sometimes just tolerate situations and actually make no advancement, just their resentment goes up, and as soon as they get a chance, they just try and exit that situation. They haven't learnt the lesson. So we have to do that with maturity. We simply cannot judge from our point of view. If there is someone who appears to be not correct, maybe not correctly even following the standard according to us, maybe they're doing things which are, you know, according to what we've heard from our teachers, from our gurus, from Prabhupada, it doesn't seem to be correct even. It might not be necessarily our right to judge. Let he who has never sinned cast the first stone, right? Who is there who is faultless? Okay, we might have, you know, a list of things that we are particularly following at the moment. We are very proud that we're following these things. But the book is not just limited to the page we're reading right now. There's a lot more to it. there's a whole range of thoughts, concepts, possibilities, paradigms, realms of existence, realms of consciousness, which we haven't turned the page to yet. And a different person may be doing something in a different realm, in a different space, and whose effects may be, according to what's written on this page of the book, might not be quite correct. A very, very common mistake made by many. But we have to understand that Krishna is the judge, and Krishna will assess. So we have to give up the idea that we are actually in a position to assess someone's behavior, unless we actually are in a factually superior position from understanding, maturity, or advancement. Now, if everyone just accepts everyone else's behavior as a good standard, that's also a problem. Because why come here then? You can go anywhere else where, you know, there are so many social groups, clubs in the world where different people with like-minded approaches come together. That doesn't give it a level of legitimacy. What gives a group level of legitimacy is when there is something that it follows legitimately. We follow Krishna. We follow Prabhupada. So the interactions amongst us are assessed according to the criteria of, are they legitimate according to Prabhupada, according to Krishna. So as one becomes more senior, as one becomes more advanced, one becomes better able to judge characteristics when they see them in those who are junior to them. They should never attempt to assess those who are senior to them. If they see something in a senior person which is undesirable, they can use that in their own life, bear it in mind, and try to make sure they do not make that same mistake. But they should not attempt to say that this person who has done this should be judged or should be punished in this way. No, leave that to that person senior and to Krishna. So we should just have a general mood of acceptance of devotees. And then, as time progresses and we will be in charge of other devotees who will be, by definition, junior to us, we can then attempt to guide them and assist them in their lives. And that's a completely bona fide part of the process. And so along the way, we will have so many interactions. We will interact with wholesome people, with persons who are not so wholesome, those who are trying to be wholesome, but they're just struggling. We'll have a whole spectrum of people. We can just see it as an item of growth for us. It says also, it takes a village to grow a child. Right? So now, growth of Krishna consciousness takes a whole village of people, including, as I said once before, the village idiot. Village idiot is also an important person in the village. There's always one guy, you know, who fits that description. And so, but you can still learn something from them. Either you can learn what not to do, even. That can be a good lesson to learn from them, what not to do. Or you can see how other persons treat that person. And then you can think, what if I'm in that position in my next life? That can be another lesson just to learn from observation. Just by observing in this world, you learn so much. So there's no shortage, actually. There's in the 11th canto, I've forgotten the details now, but all these different gurus are given. This great saintly person accepted so many different gurus, including the bird. From each person you can learn something. That's advantageous in spiritual life. So yes, association, differences of approach and interaction, we just tolerate them. We just try to progress ourselves. But we apply the heavy-handed introspection to us, not to others. For others, it should just be a quick thing. Okay, this person is doing something not quite right. I should be extra careful not to do that myself. That's it. No more meditation on it. The focus should be all on, how do I please Krishna more? Does that kind of somewhat address?
Yes, and the same applies to our own, whatever shameful feelings we have, or
yes,
ill feelings we have towards our previous conditioning.
Yeah, well, it's good to have distaste for our previous conditioning. We should be ashamed. That's a fact. Parikshit Maharaj was so ashamed of what he'd done. So imagine what we know we have done. We should definitely be ashamed of it, about it, ashamed of it. And Then there's all the previous lives issues as well. We should be ashamed, we should be highly disappointed, and we should remind ourselves of that every time we're about to do the same thing again. So that shame can be utilized. Not the modern conception in the modern world where, okay, anything you feel ashamed about, just forget it. Just act as if it didn't happen. Move on. What's the consequence of that? The consequence of that is you do the same shameful thing again and again and again. Very good to remember our faults. Very good to remember our mistakes. But not good to preoccupy ourselves with them. Good to consider them and to remind ourselves of them as and when we need to be. It's healthy, but don't let it become a depression point. Because some people, when they just consider themselves too much, how fallen they are, how lowly they are, it becomes very depressive. That's not good. That's not so helpful. Our process is so powerful that it can uplift us, uplift anyone. And therefore we can use things like shame or whatever it is. As long as they're helping us to be uplifted, we use them. But if they start to actually make us despondent and stop us doing the activities we should be doing, then they should treat them with caution and discuss with someone. So up to a point they're good. Any other questions, comments? Yes?
The doctor is helping, but the very important aspect is that the doctor protects themselves. And so I was wondering if you have any advice, how can we protect ourselves when we are in a situation where we are, when we don't really, we can see that, yes, this is not the right behavior. For example, somebody is criticizing other devotees, but at the same time, they need to be heard because they are themselves, they are hurt by other devotees doing something to them. And they need to speak about it. They need to be heard by us. So in this situation, how do we protect ourselves and also serve this devotee?
Yes, well, we have to bear in mind that revealing one's mind in confidence is also one of our loving exchanges. And so sometimes we have to balance two different ideas. So one could be the need to have this honest, open exchange, which will mean that we have to listen to certain things. And the other injunction is to not listen to certain things. So we have to go for what is the higher principle. So when we have to do that, we should do that, because it's important. What we can do is we can approach that with the mood of trying to give that person some clarity if that's what they want. We can listen to that, we can consider it, we can offer it to Krishna, actually. This is one good thing that we can always do. Whenever we receive something, it can be an item of praise, it can be some glorification, it could be some actual item, you know, like giving you something, a gift or something. Even a criticism or an insult. Now, we don't offer the insult to Krishna and say, Krishna, here, have this insult. But what we say to Krishna is, Krishna, this is an insult which was offered to me. What can I do with it? Sorry? What can I do with that insult? How do I address it? When you've got Krishna involved in that situation, we might not immediately just reject the insult, which is what we normally do. When someone insults us, we just think, who are you? We probably insult them back, or at least in our mind we do that. What about you? You know, who do you think you are? Look what you did yesterday. It's probably what comes to mind. If Krishna's involved, maybe the point changes. The point comes, okay, he's insulted me. It might not even be correct. But is there something I can take from it? Is there something I could take from it? So it's part of that process when you're hearing someone who is revealing their mind to you, is explaining to you the problems that they have, explaining their thought processes, we can hear them and we can offer them to Krishna and say, Krishna, help me untangle this. How can I respond sometimes? Or what can I say to the person? Because often the person doesn't really want to hear anything from you anyway. Often it's a fact of just getting it off the chest. That could be the response, that you don't say anything either. So knowing what to say can be assisted by Krishna. And then also, perhaps you can also think to other occasions you may have observed from other seniors. Maybe you did the same to another senior at some point, or someone else, when you were discussing with someone. How did they deal with it? How have you seen your guru deal with it? Your Guru Maharaj was in the having a similar interaction with someone. What did he do in that situation? These are all things that help us come to the right choice. Sometimes a person is speaking such nonsense that you have to actually address some of it. Sometimes a person has gone factually so far off the truth that you actually have to address it. But sometimes it could be that the truth isn't such an important factor, and that person's approach to the topic is more important. It doesn't matter that they've got a slightly wrong understanding of it. What is driving them to be in that mindset might be more worthwhile. So we don't know what part to address always. And that's why it's a bit more complex. The protection we give ourselves is by connecting everything to Krishna. So Krishna is in our consciousness, that is like a vaccine that's inoculating. So that will protect us. And we should. Our standard sadhana is also one of the background factors in it. That if our sadhana is good, we will be resistant to hearing undesirable things. We will hear undesirable things from many corners of the community, and many corners of the devotee community. Those who are more serious, those who are less serious. Typically those who are less serious will be more avid propagators of gossip and this kind of thing. Negativity. If we're inoculated with Krishna, we are also, enlivened due to our own practice and preaching, and we will be able to brush these things off. They won't go in. We will just be aware of them as a potential way that someone thinks when they're in a diseased condition. And therefore it won't affect us. If the doctor protects themselves, they don't get the disease. So our protective measures are many. The holy name is one. Our typical sadhana is another. Bringing Krishna into that interaction is a very powerful one. Because that's something you do at the time, In your consciousness, you bring Krishna immediately. You can't start doing 16 rounds at that time. It's an instant remedy. That's what I would suggest. Okay.
I'm sorry, I know it's late. I just have another quick question. Is it selfish to choose not to, kind of connect to a person who's kind of always in that kind of mood? Is it selfish to not go to the hospital, so to say, and choose not to associate with that person?
Depends on your role. If you're a doctor and you decide not to turn up to the hospital, that's a problem. Like if you're in the army and you're being sent abroad to fight and you decide I don't want to go, that's not considered very honorable. If you're a doctor, you go there, you do your job. But if you don't need to be there, if you're just coming just to have a look around and just to chat to the patients, you might avoid certain patients. It's okay. We have to protect ourselves. We have to avoid association not conducive for spiritual life. And which doesn't mean you instantly reject anyone who doesn't quite fit with you. No, everything I said earlier also applies, that all these persons are, you have to see their devotional status first. But then amongst that there can be a certain category where it's dangerous for us to. And if we feel ourselves being affected, we have to be careful of that. So it's not selfish, it's practical. But sometimes you may have to, if you're in a managerial position or if you're in a certain position of authority or lead, you're guiding the person, you might not have a choice whether to avoid the person or not. Like, a mother or a father, they can't avoid their child if the child is obnoxious. They still have to deal with them, they still have to look after them. So, some things you cannot get out of, but other things you can try, if it will cause disturbance. And we can also be checking with other devotees, other seniors, what criteria are we applying in these circumstances? You know, is it reasonable that I've been avoiding this person because of this, this, and this? Is that okay? And they can verify. They say, yeah, I think it's good. Or maybe you're not quite seeing it the right way. But yeah, avoiding devotees shouldn't be the rule. It should be the exception. Something you do only when there's something really wrong. This disciple is never meant to assess the guru. This can be a colorful statement which could be taken in all sorts of ways by those with different agendas. But until the guru says Krishna is not God, we have no basis for rejecting the guru. That's another item from Shastra somewhere. And so we have to just get the boundaries right. To get it right. Yes, there is a point at which it becomes clear that this person is not fit. And we have to reject. But the boundary is quite large. And so we have to decide where the boundary is in established, and that is established with other seniors, with advanced devotees. And so we can also learn from historical things that have happened. That will help us be better able to set the boundary. Where is the boundary where a certain person's behavior is getting to this stage? Maybe I need to think about removing myself now. It's already exceeded, maybe I need to take some other action. But it's in this category where it's causing me some disturbance, it's not quite right, what do I do about it? Maybe the answer is nothing. Maybe the answer is nothing. Let me focus on my own Krishna consciousness. I've not been appointed by Krishna to assess this person or to start prescribing corrective measures for them. So that's a whole fluid dynamic state of Krishna consciousness where different situations, different persons all have different responses that are required. Okay, well I'll stop there. Dantara Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Srila Prabhupada ki.